This is disc number 5.
They were eloquent in their distress, but they presently discovered that the fire had eaten so far up under the great log it had been built against, where it curved upward and separated itself from the ground, that a handbreadth or so of it had escaped wetting. So they patiently wrought until, with shreds and bark gathered from the undersides of sheltered logs, they coaxed the fire to burn again. Then they piled on great dead boughs till they had a roaring furnace and were glad-hearted once more. They dried their boiled ham and had a feast, and after that they sat by the fire and expanded and glorified their midnight adventure until morning, for there was not a dry spot to sleep on anywhere around. As the sun began to steal in upon the boys, drowsiness came over them, and they went out on the sandbar and lay down to sleep. They got scorched out by and by and drearily set about getting breakfast. After the meal they felt rusty and stiff-jointed and a little homesick once more. Tom saw the signs and fell to cheering up the pirates as well as he could, but they cared nothing for marbles or circus or swimming or anything. He reminded them of the imposing secret and raised a ray of cheer. While it lasted, he got them interested in a new device. This was to knock off being pirates for a while and be Indians for a change. They were attracted by this idea, so it was not long before they were stripped and striped from head to heel with black mud like so many zebras, all of them chiefs, of course, and then they went tearing through the woods to attack an English settlement. By and by, they separated into three hostile tribes and darted upon each other from ambush with dreadful war whoops and killed and scalped each other by thousands. It was a gory day. Consequently, it was an extremely satisfactory one. They assembled in camp toward supper time, hungry and happy. But now a difficulty arose. Hostile Indians could not break the bread of hospitality together without first making peace, and this was a simple impossibility without smoking a pipe of peace. There was no other process that ever they had heard of. Two of the savages almost wished they had remained pirates. However, there was no other way. So with such show of cheerfulness as they could muster, they called for the pipe and took their whiff as it passed in due form. And behold, they were glad they had gone into savagery, for they had gained something. They found that they could now smoke a little without having to go and hunt for a lost knife. They did not get sick enough to be seriously uncomfortable. They were not likely to fool away this high promise for lack of effort. No, they practiced cautiously after supper with right fair success, and so they spent a jubilant evening. They were prouder and happier in their new acquirement than they would have been in the scalping and skinning of the Six Nations. We will leave them to smoke and chatter and brag, since we have no further use for them at present. Chapter 17. Pirates at Their Own Funeral. But there was no hilarity in the little town that same tranquil Saturday afternoon. The Harpers and Aunt Polly's family were being put into mourning, with great grief and many tears. An unusual quiet possessed the village, although it was ordinarily quiet enough in all conscience. The villagers conducted their concerns with an absent air and talked little, but they sighed often. The Saturday holiday seemed a burden to the children. They had no heart in their sports and gradually gave them up. In the afternoon, Becky Thatcher found herself moping about the deserted schoolhouse yard and feeling very melancholy. But she found nothing there to comfort her. She soliloquized.
Oh, If I only had a brass andiron knob again! But I haven't got anything now to remember him by."
And she choked back a little sob. Presently she stopped and said to herself, "It was right here. Oh, if it was to do over again, I wouldn't say that. I wouldn't say it for the whole world. But he's gone now. I'll never, never, never see him any more." This thought broke her down, and she wandered away with the tears rolling down her cheeks. Then quite a group of boys and girls, playmates of Tom and Joe's, came by and stood looking over the paling fence and talking in reverent tones of how Tom did so-and-so the last time they saw him, and how Joe said this and that small trifle, pregnant with awful prophecy, as they could easily see now. And each speaker pointed out the exact spot where the lost lad stood at the time, and then added something like, "And I was a-standing just so, just as I am now, and as if you was him, I was as close as that, and he smiled, just this way. And then something seemed to go all over me, like, awful, you know, and I never thought what it meant, of course, but I can see now." Then there was a dispute about who saw the dead boys last in life, and many claimed that dismal distinction, and offered evidences, more or less tempered with by the witness. And when it was ultimately decided who did see the departed last, and exchanged the last words with them, the lucky parties took upon themselves a sort of sacred importance, and were gaped at and envied by all the rest. One poor chap, who had no other grandeur to offer, said with tolerably manifest pride in the remembrance, "Well, Tom Sawyer, he licked me once." But that bid for glory was a failure. Most of the boys could say that, and so that cheapened the distinction too much. The group loitered away, still recalling memories of the lost heroes in awed voices. When the Sunday school hour was finished the next morning, the bell began to toll instead of ringing in the usual way. It was a very still Sabbath, and the mournful sound seemed in keeping with the musing hush that lay upon nature. The villagers began to gather, loitering a moment in the vestibule to converse in whispers about the sad event. But there was no whispering in the house, only the funereal rustling of dresses as the women gathered to their seats disturbed the silence there. None could remember when the little church had been so full before. There was finally a waiting pause, an expectant dumbness, and then Aunt Polly entered, followed by Sid and Mary, and they by the Harper family, all in deep black. And the whole congregation, the old minister as well, rose reverently and stood until the mourners were seated in the front pew. There was another communing silence, broken at intervals by muffled sobs, and then the minister spread his hands abroad and prayed. A moving hymn was sung, and the text followed, "I am the resurrection and the life." As the service proceeded, the clergyman drew such pictures of the graces, the winning ways, and the rare promise of the lost lads that every soul there, thinking he recognized these pictures, felt a pang in remembering that he had persistently blinded himself to them always before, and had as persistently seen only faults and flaws in the poor boys. The minister related many a touching incident in the lives of the departed, too, which illustrated their sweet, generous natures, and the people could easily see now how noble and beautiful those episodes were, and remembered with grief that at the time they occurred they had seemed rank rascalities, well deserving of the cowhide. The congregation became more and more moved as the pathetic tale went on, till at last the whole company broke down and joined the weeping mourners in a chorus of anguished sobs, the preacher himself giving way to his feelings and crying in the pulpit. There was a rustle in the gallery, which nobody noticed. A moment later, the church door creaked. The minister raised his streaming eyes above his handkerchief and stood transfixed. First one and then another pair of eyes followed the minister's, and then, almost with one impulse, the congregation rose and stared while the three dead boys came marching up the aisle, Tom in the lead, Joe next, and Huck, a ruin of drooping rags, sneaking sheepishly in the rear. They had been hid in the unused gallery, listening to their own funeral sermon. Aunt Polly, Mary, and the Harpers threw themselves upon their restored ones, smothered them with kisses, and poured out thanksgivings, while poor Huck stood abashed and uncomfortable, not knowing exactly what to do or where to hide from so many unwelcoming eyes. He wavered and started to slink away, but Tom seized him and said,
"Aunt Polly, it ain't fair. Somebody's got to be glad to see Huck."
"And so they shall. I'm glad to see him, poor motherless thing."
And the loving attentions Aunt Polly lavished upon him were the one thing capable of making him more uncomfortable than he was before. Suddenly, the minister shouted at the top of his voice,
"Praise God from whom all blessings flow! Sing and put your hearts in it!"
And they did. Old Hundred swelled up with a triumphant burst, and while it shook the rafters, Tom Sawyer the pirate looked around upon the envying juveniles about him and confessed in his heart that this was the proudest moment of his life. As the sold congregation trooped out, they said they would almost be willing to be made ridiculous again to hear Old Hundred sung like that once more. Tom got more cuffs and kisses that day, according to Aunt Polly's varying moods, than he had earned before in a year, and he hardly knew which expressed the most gratefulness to God and affection for himself. Chapter 18. Tom Reveals His Dream Secret. That was Tom's great secret. The scheme to return home with his brother pirates and attend their own funerals. They had paddled over to the Missouri shore on a log at dusk on Saturday, landing 5 or 6 miles below the village. They had slept in the woods at the edge of the town till nearly daylight, and had then crept through back lanes and alleys and finished their sleep in the gallery of the church among a chaos of invalided benches. At breakfast, Monday morning, Aunt Polly and Mary were very loving to Tom and very attentive to his wants. There was an unusual amount of talk. In the course of it, Aunt Polly said,
"Well, I don't say it wasn't a fine joke, Tom, to keep everybody suffering most a week so you boys had a good time. But it is a pity you could be so hard-hearted as to let me suffer so.
If you could come over on a log to go to your funeral, you could have come over and give me a hint some way that you weren't dead, but only run off."
"Yes, you could have done that, Tom," said Mary. "And I believe you would if you had thought of it."
"Would you, Tom?"
said Aunt Polly, her face lighting wistfully.
"Say now, would you, if you'd thought of it?"
Well, I don't know. 'Twould have spoiled everything."
"Tom, I hoped you loved me that much," said Aunt Polly with a grieved tone that discomforted the boy.
It would have been something if you'd cared enough to think of it, even if you didn't do it.
Now, Auntie, that ain't any harm, pleaded Mary. It's only Tom's giddy way. He is always in such a rush that he never thinks of anything.
More's the pity. Sid would have thought, and Sid would have come and done it, too. Tom, you'll look back some day, when it's too late, and wish you'd cared a little more for me, when it would have cost you so little.
Now, Auntie, you know I do care for you, said Tom.
I'd know it better if you acted more like it.
I wish now I'd thought, said Tom with a repentant tone.
But I dreamed about you anyway. That's something, ain't it?
It ain't much. A cat does that much.
But it's better than nothing.
What did you dream?
Why, Wednesday night, I dreamt that you was sitting over there by the bed, and Sid was sitting by the wood box, and Mary next to him.
Well, so we did. So we always do. I'm glad your dreams could take even that much trouble about us.
And I dreamt that Joe Harper's mother was here.
Why, she was here. Did you dream any more?
Oh, lots. But it's so dim now.
Well, try to recollect, can't you?
Somehow it seems to me that the wind blowed the...
Try harder, Tom. The wind did blow something. Come.
Tom pressed his fingers on his forehead an anxious minute and then said,
I've got it now. I've got it now. It blowed the candle.
Mercy on us. Oh, go on, Tom. Go on.
And it seems to me that you said, why, I believe that that door...
Go on, Tom.
Just let me study a moment. Just a moment. Oh, yes. You said you believed the door was open.
As I'm sitting here, I did. Didn't I, Mary? Go on.
And then, well, I won't be certain, but it seems like as if you made Sid go and...
Well, what did I make him do, Tom? What did I make him do?
You made him shut it.
Well, for the land's sake, I never heard the beat of that in all my days.
Don't tell me there ain't anything in dreams anymore. Serene Harper shall know of this before I'm an hour older. I'd like to see her get around this with her rubbish about superstition.
Go on, Tom.
Oh, it's all getting just as bright as day now. Next, you said I weren't bad, only mischievous and harum-scarum, and not any more responsible than... I think it was a colt or something.
And so it was. Well, goodness gracious. Go on, Tom.
And then you began to cry.
So I did. So I did. Not the first time, neither.
And then Mrs. Harper, she began to cry and said Joe was just the same, and she wished she hadn't whipped him for taking cream when she throwed it out her own self.
Tom, the spirit was upon you. You was a prophesying. That's what you was doing. Land alive, go on, Tom.
Well, then Sid, he said,
I don't think I said anything, said Sid.
Yes, you did, Sid, said Mary.
Shut your heads and let Tom go on.
What did he say, Tom?
He said, I think, he said, he hoped I was better off where I was gone to. But if I'd been better sometime...
There! Do you hear that? It was his very words.
And you shut him up sharp.
I did. There must have been an angel there. There was an angel there somewheres. And Mrs. Harper told about Joe scaring her with the firecracker. And you told about Peter and the painkiller.
Just as true as I live.
And then there was a whole lot of talk about dragging the river for us and about having the funeral Sunday. And then you and old Miss Harper hugged and cried, and she went.
It happened just so. It happened just so, as sure as I'm a-sittin' in these very tracks. Tom, you couldn't told it more like if you'd have seen it.
And then what?
Go on, Tom.
Then I thought you prayed for me, and I could see you and hear every word you said. And you went to bed, and I was so sorry that I took and wrote on a piece of sycamore bark, "We ain't dead, we are only off being pirates," and put it on the table by the candle. And then you looked so good, laying there asleep, that I thought I went and leaned over and kissed you on the lips.
Did you, Tom? Did you? I just forgive you everything for that.
And she seized the boy in a crushing embrace that made him feel like the guiltiest of villains. It was very kind, even though it was only a dream, Sid soliloquized just audibly.
Shut up, Sid! A body does just the same in a dream as he'd do if he was awake. Here's a big Milam apple I've been saving for you, Tom, if you was ever found again. Now, go along to school. I'm thankful to the good God and Father of us all I've got you back. That's long-suffering and merciful to them that believe on him and keep his word, though goodness knows I'm unworthy of it. But if only the worthy ones got his blessings and had his hand to help them over the rough places, there's few enough would smile here or ever enter into his rest when the long night comes. Go along, Sid, Mary, Tom. Take yourselves off. You've hindered me long enough.
The children left for school and the old lady to call on Mrs. Harper and vanquish her realism with Tom's marvelous dream. Sid had better judgment than to utter the thought that was in his mind as he left the house. It was this. Pretty thin, as long a dream as that without any mistakes in it.
What a hero Tom was become now. He did not go skipping and prancing, but moved with a dignified swagger, as became a pirate who felt that the public eye was on him, and indeed it was. He tried not to seem to see the looks or hear the remarks as he passed along, but they were food and drink to him. Smaller boys than himself flocked at his heels, as proud to be seen with him and tolerated by him as if he had been the drummer at the head of a procession, or the elephant leading a menagerie into town. Boys of his own size pretended not to know he had been away at all, but they were consuming with envy, nevertheless. They would have given anything to have that swarthy, sun-tanned skin of his and his glittering notoriety, and Tom would not have parted with either for a circus. At school, the children made so much of him and of Joe, and delivered such eloquent admiration from their eyes that the two heroes were not long in becoming insufferably stuck up. They began to tell their adventures to hungry listeners, but they only began. It was not a thing likely to have an end with imaginations like theirs to furnish material. And finally, when they got out their pipes and went serenely puffing around, the very summit of glory was reached. Tom decided that he could be independent of Becky Thatcher now. Glory was sufficient. He would live for glory. Now that he was distinguished, maybe she would be wanting to make up. Well, let her.
she should see that he could be as indifferent as some other people. Presently, she arrived. Tom pretended not to see her. He moved away and joined a group of boys and girls and began to talk. Soon he observed that she was tripping gaily back and forth with flushed face and dancing eyes, pretending to be busy chasing schoolmates and screaming with laughter when she made a capture. But he noticed that she always made her captures in his vicinity, and that she seemed to cast a conscious eye in his direction at such times, too. It gratified all the vicious vanity that was in him, and so, instead of winning him, it only set him up the more, and made him the more diligent to avoid betraying that he knew she was about. Presently, she gave over skylarking and moved irresolutely about, sighing once or twice and glancing furtively and wistfully toward Tom. Then she observed that now Tom was talking more particularly to Amy Lawrence than to anyone else. She felt a sharp pang and grew disturbed and uneasy at once. She tried to go away, but her feet were treacherous and carried her to the group instead. She said to a girl almost at Tom's elbow, with sham vivacity,
"Why, Mary Austin, you bad girl, why didn't you come to Sunday school?"
"I did come. Didn't you see me?"
"Why, no. Did you? Where did you sit?"
"I was in Miss Peters' class, where I always go. I saw you."
"Did you? Why,
it's funny I didn't see you. I wanted to tell you about the picnic."
"Oh, that's jolly. Who's going to give it?"
"My ma's going to let me have one."
"Oh, goody. I hope she'll let me come."
"Well, she will. The picnic's for me. She'll let anybody come that I want, and I want you."
"That's ever so nice. When is it going to be?"
"By and by. Maybe about vacation."
"Oh, won't it be fun? You going to have all the girls and boys?"
"Yes, everyone that's friends to me, or wants to be."
And she glanced ever so furtively at Tom. But he talked right along to Amy Lawrence about the terrible storm on the island, and how the lightning tore the great sycamore tree all to flinders while he was standing within 3 feet of it.
"Oh, may I come?"
said Gracie Miller.
"Yes." "And me?" said Sally Rogers.
"Yes."
"And me, too?" said Susie Harper. "And Joe?"
"Yes." And so on, with clapping of joyful hands, till all the group had begged for invitations but Tom and Amy. Then Tom turned coolly away, still talking, and took Amy with him. Becky's lips trembled, and the tears came to her eyes. She hid these signs with a forced gaiety and went on chattering, but the life had gone out of the picnic now, and out of everything else. She got away as soon as she could and hid herself and had what her sex call a good cry. Then she sat moody with wounded pride till the bell rang. She roused up now with a vindictive cast in her eye and gave her plaited tails a shake and said she knew what she'd do. At recess, Tom continued his flirtation with Amy with jubilant self-satisfaction, and he kept drifting about to find Becky and lacerate her with the performance. At last he spied her, but there was a sudden falling of his mercury. She was sitting cozily on a little bench behind the schoolhouse, looking at a picture book with Alfred Temple. And so absorbed were they, and their heads so close together over the book, that they did not seem to be conscious of anything in the world besides. Jealousy ran red hot through Tom's veins. He began to hate himself for throwing away the chance Becky had offered for a reconciliation. He called himself a fool and all the hard names he could think of. He wanted to cry with vexation.
Amy chatted happily along as they walked, for her heart was singing, but Tom's tongue had lost its function. He did not hear what Amy was saying, and whenever she paused expectantly, he could only stammer an awkward assent, which was as often misplaced as otherwise. He kept drifting to the rear of the schoolhouse again and again to sear his eyeballs with the hateful spectacle there. He could not help it. And it maddened him to see, as he thought he saw, that Becky Thatcher never once suspected that he was even in the land of the living. But she did see, nevertheless, and she knew she was winning her fight, too, and was glad to see him suffer as she had suffered. Amy's happy prattle became intolerable. Tom hinted at things he had to attend to, things that must be done, and time was fleeting. But in vain, the girl chirped on. Tom thought, "Oh, hang her. Ain't I ever going to get rid of her?" At last, he must be attending to those things. And she said artlessly that she would be around when school let out, and he hastened away, hating her for it. "Any other boy," Tom thought, grating his teeth, "any boy in the whole town but that St. Louis smarty that thinks he dresses so fine and is aristocracy. Oh, all right. I'll lick you the first day you ever saw this town, mister, and I'll lick you again. You just wait till I catch you out. I'll just take and..." And he went through the motions of thrashing an imaginary boy, pummeling the air and kicking and gouging. "Oh, you do you? You holler enough, do you? Now then, let that learn you." And so the imaginary flogging was finished to his satisfaction. Tom fled home at noon. His conscience could not endure any more of Amy's grateful happiness, and his jealousy could bear no more of the other distress. Becky resumed her picture inspections with Alfred, but as the minutes dragged along and no Tom came to suffer, her triumph began to cloud, and she lost interest. Gravity and absent-mindedness followed, and then melancholy. 2 or 3 times she pricked up her ear at a footstep, but it was a false hope. No Tom came. At last she grew entirely miserable and wished she hadn't carried it so far. When poor Alfred, seeing that he was losing her, he did not know how, kept exclaiming, "Oh, here's a jolly one, look at this!" She lost patience at last and said, "Oh, don't bother me, I don't care for them," and burst into tears and got up and walked away. Alfred dropped alongside and was going to try to comfort her, but she said, "Go away and leave me alone, can't you? I hate you." So the boy halted, wondering what he could have done, for she had said she would look at pictures all through the nooning. And she walked on, crying. Then Alfred went musing into the deserted schoolhouse. He was humiliated and angry. He easily guessed his way to the truth. The girl had simply made a convenience of him to vent her spite upon Tom Sawyer. He was far from hating Tom the less when this thought occurred to him. He wished there was some way to get that boy into trouble without much risk to himself. Tom's spelling book fell under his eye. Here was his opportunity. He gratefully opened to the lesson for the afternoon and poured ink upon the page. Becky, glancing in at a window behind him at the moment, saw the act and moved on without discovering herself. She started homeward now, intending to find Tom and tell him. Tom would be thankful, and their troubles would be healed. Before she was halfway home, however, she had changed her mind. The thought of Tom's treatment of her when she was talking about her picnic came scorching back and filled her with shame. She resolved to let him get whipped on the damaged spelling book's account and to hate him forever into the bargain. Chapter 19. The Cruelty of I Didn't Think. Tom arrived at home in a dreary mood, and the first thing his aunt said to him showed him that he had brought his sorrows to an unpromising market.
Tom, I've a notion to skin you alive. Auntie, what have I done?
Well, you've done enough. Here I go over to Sereny Harper like an old softy, expecting I'm going to make her believe all that rubbish about that dream, when lo and behold you, she'd found out from Joe that you was over here and heard all the talk we had that night. Tom, I don't know what is to become of a boy that will act like that. It makes me feel so bad to think you could let me go to Sereny Harper and make such a fool of myself. And never say a word.
This was a new aspect of the thing. His smartness of the morning had seemed to Tom a good joke before, and very ingenious. It merely looked mean and shabby now. He hung his head and could not think of anything to say for a moment. Then he said,
Auntie, I wish I hadn't done it, but I didn't think. Oh, child, you never think. You never think of anything but your own selfishness.
You could think to come all the way over here from Jackson's Island in the night to laugh at our troubles, and you could think to fool me with a lie about a dream, but you couldn't ever think to pity us and save us from sorrow.
Auntie, I know now it was mean, but I didn't mean to be mean. I didn't, honest. And besides, I didn't come over here to laugh at you that night.
What did you come for, then?
It was to tell you not to be uneasy about us, because we hadn't got drowned.
Tom, I would be the thankfulest soul in this world if I could believe you ever had as good a thought as that. But you know you never did. And I know it, Tom.
Indeed, indeed, I did, Auntie. I wish I may never stir if I didn't.
Oh, Tom, don't lie. Don't do it. It only makes things 100 times worse.
It ain't a lie, Auntie. It's the truth. I wanted to keep you from grieving. That was all that made me come.
I'd give the world to believe that. It would cover up a power of sins, Tom. I'd most be glad you'd run off and acted so bad. But it ain't reasonable, because why didn't you tell me, child?
Why, you see, when you got to talking about the funeral, I just got all full of the idea of our coming and hiding in the church, and I couldn't somehow bear to spoil it. So I just put the bark back in my pocket and kept mum.
What bark?
The bark I had wrote on to tell you we'd gone pirating. Oh, I wish now you'd waked up when I kissed you. I do, honest.
The hard lines in his aunt's face relaxed, and a sudden tenderness dawned in her eyes.
Did you kiss me, Tom?
Why, yes, I did.
Are you sure you did, Tom?
Well, yes, I did, Auntie. Certain sure.
What did you kiss me for, Tom?
Because I loved you so, and you laid there moaning, and I was so sorry.
The words sounded like truth. The old lady could not hide a tremor in her voice when she said,
"Kiss me again, Tom, and be off with you to school now, and don't bother me any more."
The moment he was gone, she ran to a closet and got out the ruin of a jacket which Tom had gone pirating in. Then she stopped, with it in her hand, and said to herself,
"No, I don't dare. Poor boy, I reckon he's lied about it. But it's a blessed, blessed lie. There's such a comfort come from it. I hope the Lord, I know the Lord will forgive him, because it was such good-heartedness in him to tell it. But I don't want to find out it's a lie. I won't look.
She put the jacket away and stood by, musing a minute. Twice she put out her hand to take the garment again, and twice she refrained. Once more she ventured, and this time she fortified herself with the thought,
"It's a good lie. It's a good lie. I won't let it grieve me."
So she sought the jacket pocket. A moment later, she was reading Tom's piece of bark through flowing tears and saying,
"I could forgive the boy now if he'd committed a million sins."
Chapter 20. Tom takes Becky's punishment. There was something about Aunt Polly's manner when she kissed Tom that swept away his low spirits and made him light-hearted and happy again. He started to school and had the luck of coming upon Becky Thatcher at the head of Meadow Lane. His mood always determined his manner. Without a moment's hesitation, he ran to her and said,
"I acted mighty mean today, Becky, and I'm so sorry. I won't ever, ever do that way again as long as ever I live. Please make up, won't you?"
The girl stopped and looked him scornfully in the face.
"I'll thank you to keep yourself to yourself, Mr. Thomas Sawyer. I'll never speak to you again."
She tossed her head and passed on. Tom was so stunned that he had not even presence of mind enough to say, "Who cares, Miss Smarty?" until the right time to say it had gone by. So he said nothing. But he was in a fine rage, nevertheless. He moped into the schoolyard, wishing she were a boy and imagining how he would trounce her if she were. He presently encountered her and delivered a stinging remark as he passed. She hurled one in return, and the angry breach was complete. It seemed to Becky, in her hot resentment, that she could hardly wait for school to take in. She was so impatient to see Tom flogged for the injured spelling book. If she had had any lingering notion of exposing Alfred Temple, Tom's offensive fling had driven it entirely away. Poor girl, she did not know how fast she was nearing trouble herself. The master, Mr. Dobbins, had reached middle age with an unsatisfied ambition. The darling of his desires was to be a doctor, but poverty had decreed that he should be nothing higher than a village schoolmaster. Every day he took a mysterious book out of his desk and absorbed himself in it at times when no classes were reciting. He kept that book under lock and key. There was not an urchin in school but was perishing to have a glimpse of it, but the chance never came. Every boy and girl had a theory about the nature of that book, but no two theories were alike, and there was no way of getting at the facts in the case. Now, as Becky was passing by the desk which stood near the door, she noticed that the key was in the lock. It was a precious moment. She glanced around, found herself alone, and the next instant she had the book in her hands. The title page, Professor Somebody's Anatomy, carried no information to her mind, so she began to turn the leaves. She came at once upon a handsomely engraved and colored frontispiece, a human figure, stark, naked. At that moment, a shadow fell on the page, and Tom Sawyer stepped in at the door and caught a glimpse of the picture. Becky snatched at the book to close it and had the hard luck to tear the pictured plate half down the middle. She thrust the volume into the desk, turned the key, and burst out crying with shame and vexation.
"Tom Sawyer, you are just as mean as you can be to sneak up on a person and look at what they're looking at."
"How can I know you was looking at anything?"
"You ought to be ashamed of yourself, Tom Sawyer. You know you're going to tell on me, and, oh, what shall I do? What shall I do? I'll be whipped, and I never was whipped in school."
Then she stamped her little foot and said,
"Be so mean if you want to. I know something that's going to happen. You just wait and you'll see." "Hateful, hateful, hateful!"
And she flung out of the house with a new explosion of crying. Tom stood still, rather flustered by this onslaught. Presently, he said to himself,
"What a curious kind of fool a girl is. Never been licked in school? Shucks! What's a licking? That's just like a girl. They're so thin-skinned and chicken-hearted." "Well, of course I ain't gonna tell old Dobbins on this little fool, because there's other ways of getting even on her that ain't so mean. But what of it? Old Dobbins will ask who it was tore his book. Nobody'll answer. Then he'll do just the way he always does. Ask first one and then t'other. And when he comes to the right girl, he'll know it without any telling. Girls' faces always tell on them. They ain't got any backbone. She'll get licked." Well, it's a kind of a tight place for Becky Thatcher, because there ain't any way out of it. Tom conned the thing a moment longer and then added, "All right, though. She'd like to see me in just such a fix. Let her sweat it out." Tom joined the mob of Skylarkin scholars outside. In a few moments, the master arrived and school took in. Tom did not feel a strong interest in his studies. Every time he stole a glance at the girl's side of the room, Becky's face troubled him. Considering all things, he did not want to pity her, and yet it was all he could do to help it. He could get up no exultation that was really worthy the name. Presently, the spelling book discovery was made, and Tom's mind was entirely full of his own matters for a while after that. Becky roused up from her lethargy of distress and showed good interest in the proceedings. She did not expect that Tom could get out of his trouble by denying that he spilt the ink on the book himself, and she was right. The denial only seemed to make the thing worse for Tom. Becky supposed she would be glad of that, and she tried to believe she was glad of it, but she found she was not certain. When the worst came to the worst, she had an impulse to get up and tell on Alfred Temple. But she made an effort and forced herself to keep still, because, said she to herself, "He'll tell about me tearing the picture, sure. I wouldn't say a word, not to save his life." Tom took his whipping and went back to his seat, not at all broken-hearted, for he thought it was possible that he had unknowingly upset the ink on the spelling book himself in some skylarking bout. He had denied it for form's sake and because it was custom, and had stuck to the denial from principle. A whole hour drifted by. The master sat nodding in his throne. The air was drowsy with the hum of study. By and by, Mr. Dobbins straightened himself up, yawned, then unlocked his desk and reached for his book, but seemed undecided whether to take it out or leave it. Most of the pupils glanced up languidly, but there were two among them that watched his movements with intent eyes. Mr. Dobbins fingered his book absently for a while, then took it out and settled himself in his chair,
to read. Tom shot a glance at Becky. He had seen a hunted and helpless rabbit look as she did, with a gun leveled at its head. Instantly, he forgot his quarrel with her. Quick, something must be done. Done in a flash, too. But the very imminence of the emergency paralyzed his invention. Good! He had an inspiration. He would run and snatch the book, spring through the door, and fly. But his resolution shook for one little instant, and the chance was lost. The master opened the volume. If Tom only had the wasted opportunity back again. Too late. There was no help for Becky now, he said. The next moment, the master faced the school. Every eye sank under his gaze. There was that in it which smote even the innocent with fear. There was silence while one might count 10. The master was gathering his wrath. Then he spoke. Who tore this book? There was not a sound. One could have heard a pin drop. The stillness continued. The master searched face after face for signs of guilt.
Benjamin Rogers, did you tear this book?
A denial. Another pause.
Joseph Harper, did you?
Another denial. Tom's uneasiness grew more and more intense under the slow torture of these proceedings. The master scanned the ranks of boys, considered a while, then turned to the girls.
Amy Lawrence?
A shake of the head.
Gracie Miller?
The same sign.
Susan Harper? Did you do this?
Another negative. The next girl was Becky Thatcher. Tom was trembling from head to foot with excitement and a sense of the hopelessness of the situation.
Rebecca Thatcher?
Tom glanced at her face. It was white with terror.
Did you tear... No, look me in the face.
Her hands rose in appeal. Did you tear this book? A thought shot like lightning through Tom's brain. He sprang to his feet and shouted,
I done it!
The school stared in perplexity at this incredible folly. Tom stood a moment to gather his dismembered faculties, and when he stepped forward to go to his punishment, the surprise, the gratitude, the adoration that shone upon him out of poor Becky's eyes seemed pay enough for 100 floggings. Inspired by the splendor of his own act, he took without an outcry the most merciless flaying that even Mr. Dobbins had ever administered, and also received with indifference the added cruelty of a command to remain 2 hours after school should be dismissed, for he knew who would wait for him outside till his captivity was done, and not count the tedious time as loss, either. Tom went to bed that night, planning vengeance against Alfred Temple, for with shame and repentance Becky had told him all, not forgetting her own treachery. But even the longing for vengeance had to give way soon to pleasanter musings, and he fell asleep at last, with Becky's latest words lingering dreamily in his ear.
Tom, how could you be so noble?
Chapter 21. Eloquence and the Master's Gilded Dome. Vacation was approaching. The schoolmaster, always severe, grew severer and more exacting than ever, for he wanted the school to make a good showing on examination day. His rod and his ferule were seldom idle now, at least among the smaller pupils. Only the biggest boys and young ladies of 18 and 20 escaped lashing. Mr. Dobbins's lashings were very vigorous ones, too, for although he carried, under his wig, a perfectly bald and shiny head, he had only reached middle age, and there was no sign of feebleness in his muscle. As the great day approached, all the tyranny that was in him came to the surface. He seemed to take a vindictive pleasure in punishing the least shortcomings. The consequence was that the smaller boys spent their days in terror and suffering, and their nights in plotting revenge. They threw away no opportunity to do the master a mischief, but he kept ahead all the time. The retribution that followed every vengeful success was so sweeping and majestic that the boys always retired from the field badly worsted. At last, they conspired together and hit upon a plan that promised a dazzling victory. They swore in the sign painter's boy, told him the scheme, and asked his help. He had his own reasons for being delighted, for the master boarded in his father's family and had given the boy ample cause to hate him. The master's wife would go on a visit to the country in a few days, and there would be nothing to interfere with the plan. The master always prepared himself for great occasions by getting pretty well fuddled, and a sign-painter's boy said that when the dominie had reached the proper condition on examination evening, he would manage the thing while he napped in his chair. Then he would have him awakened at the right time and hurried away to school. In the fullness of time, the interesting occasion arrived. At 8 in the evening, the schoolhouse was brilliantly lighted and adorned with wreaths and festoons of foliage and flowers. The master sat throned in his great chair upon a raised platform with his blackboard behind him. He was looking tolerably mellow. 3 rows of benches on each side and 6 rows in front of him were occupied by the dignitaries of the town and by the parents of the pupils. To his left, back of the rows of citizens, was a spacious temporary platform upon which were seated the scholars who were to take part in the exercises of the evening. Rows of small boys, washed and dressed to an intolerable state of discomfort. Rows of gawky big boys. Snowbanks of girls and young ladies clad in lawn and muslin and conspicuously conscious of their bare arms, their grandmother's ancient trinkets, their bits of pink and blue ribbon, and the flowers in their hair. All the rest of the house was filled with non-participating scholars. The exercises began. A very little boy stood up and sheepishly recited,
"You'd scarce expect one of my age to speak in public on the stage,"
etc., accompanying himself with the painfully exact and spasmodic gestures which a machine might have used, supposing the machine to be a trifle out of order. But he got through safely, though cruelly scared, and got a fine round of applause when he made his manufactured bow and retired. A little shamefaced girl lisped,
"Mary had a little lamb,"
etc., performed a compassion-inspiring curtsy, got her meed of applause, and sat down flushed and happy. Tom Sawyer stepped forward with conceited confidence and soared into the unquenchable and indestructible,
"Give me liberty or give me death,"
speech, with fine fury and frantic gesticulation, and broke down in the middle of it. A ghastly stage fright seized him. His legs quaked under him, and he was like to choke. True, he had the manifest sympathy of the house, but he had the house's silence, too, which was even worse than its sympathy. The master frowned, and this completed the disaster. Tom struggled a while, and then retired, utterly defeated. There was a weak attempt at applause, but it died early. The boy stood on the burning deck, followed. Also, the Assyrian came down, and other declamatory gems. Then there were reading exercises and a spelling fight. The meager Latin class recited with honor. The prime feature of the evening was in order now. Original compositions by the young ladies. Each in her turn stepped forward to the edge of the platform, cleared her throat, held up her manuscript tied with dainty ribbon, and proceeded to read with labored attention to expression and punctuation. The themes were the same that had been illuminated upon similar occasions by their mothers before them, their grandmothers, and doubtless all their ancestors in the female line clear back to the Crusades. Friendship was one, memories of other days, religion and history, dreamland, the advantages of culture, forms of political government compared and contrasted, melancholy, filial love, heart longings, etc., etc. A prevalent feature in these compositions was a nursed and petted melancholy. Another was a wasteful and opulent gush of fine language. Another was a tendency to lug in by the ears particularly prized words and phrases until they were worn entirely out. And a peculiarity that conspicuously marked and marred them was the inveterate and intolerable sermon that wagged its crippled tail at the end of each and every one of them. No matter what the subject might be, a brain-racking effort was made to squirm it into some aspect or other that the moral and religious mind could contemplate with edification. The glaring insincerity of these sermons was not sufficient to compass the banishment of the fashion from the schools, and it is not sufficient today. It never will be sufficient while the world stands, perhaps. There is no school in all our land where the young ladies do not feel obliged to close their compositions with a sermon, and you will find that the sermon of the most frivolous and the least religious girl in the school is always the longest and the most relentlessly pious. But enough of this. Homely truth is unpalatable. Let us return to the examination. The first composition that was read was one entitled, Is This Then Life? Perhaps the reader can endure an extract from it. In the common walks of life, with what delightful emotions does the youthful mind look forward to some anticipated scene of festivity? Imagination is busy sketching rose-tinted pictures of joy. In fancy, the voluptuous votary of fashion sees herself amid the festive throng, the observed of all observers. Her graceful form, arrayed in snowy robes, is whirling through the mazes of the joyous dance. Her eye is brightest, her step is lightest in the gay assembly. In such delicious fancies time quickly glides by, and the welcome hour arrives for her entrance into the Elysian world of which she has had such bright dreams. How fairy-like does everything appear to her enchanted vision! Each new scene is more charming than the last. But after a while she finds that beneath this goodly exterior all is vanity. The flattery which once charmed her soul now grates harshly upon her ear. The ballroom has lost its charms, and with wasted health and embittered heart, she turns away with the conviction that earthly pleasures cannot satisfy the longings of the soul. And so forth and so on. There was a buzz of gratification from time to time during the reading, accompanied by whispered ejaculations of, "How sweet! How eloquent! So true!" etc., and after the thing had closed with a peculiarly afflicting sermon, the applause was enthusiastic. Then arose a slim, melancholy girl, whose face had the interesting paleness that comes of pills and indigestion, and read a poem.
This is the end of disc number 5. Please insert disc number 6.